Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
They believe that NATO is still determined to finish off Russia.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Galt and Jason Fields.
Hello and welcome to War College. I'm your host, Matthew Galt. Jason Fields is busy with a sick kid tonight. Oh, a few days before Halloween, in the early years of the War on Terror, Naveed Jamali took a Russian spy out to eat at Hooters. After they finished the meal, the pair walked out of the restaurant and into an FBI sting. Agents rushed Jamali and arrested him, but it was theater. The arrest was fake, but the Russian spy was not. Jamali was a double agent. He's here with us today to share his story. He's an interesting man with a fascinating life and career, and he's also the author of How to Catch a Russian Spy, a memoir of the years he spent as a double agent, which has just come out in paperback and includes an epilogue titled The Russians Are Coming. Naveed, thank you so much for joining us. All right, so my first question for you is, do you have any tattoos?
Yes, I do. It's something with the intro of Hooters, of course there has to be a tattoo, right? It just goes hand in glove. it's a great question. And the reality is you do this long enough. And, you know, I was doing this for 3 years. It weighs on you, and there's a little bit of a psychological thing that happens. You're living undercover and you sort of wonder at a certain point if you're ever going to get caught. So yes, indeed, I did get my code name, the FBI code name, which was Green Kryptonite, tattooed on my forearm in Morse code. And I did it because, you know, again, it's just this thing that you're living in this world. No one knows what you're doing. And you wonder, does anyone know that you're doing this? Does it matter? And so it was sort of a way of pushing that boundary. Towards the end of it, you sort of take a little bit of risk. And it's just a psychological progression that happens with anyone who's doing this. So, yes, short answer, I do have a tattoo. The tattoo is in Morse code. It says Green Kryptonite, which was my FBI code.
All right. Well, let's back up to way before you got the tattoo. And you tell me a little bit about, or tell the audience rather, a little bit about your parents' bookstore.
Sure. So it wasn't really just a bookstore. What my parents ran, both my parents, as the name Naveed Jamali implies, I can't trace my lineage down to the Mayflower. They're both immigrants. My father from Pakistan and my mother from France. They met in New York, and they're both academics. And they started a small company that was designed primarily to provide research material pre-internet to law firms and the such, but it eventually morphed into a federal contracting firm. So they would provide books and training material to West Point or Annapolis or so that sort of stuff. So it was a government contracting vehicle. And, they didn't necessarily have access to classified information, but they did have access to government reports and the like. So oddly enough, it just became an attraction point for, if you can believe it, the Soviets and the Russians.
Okay, so they would come in looking specifically for documents. How did you know that they were Soviets, or how did your parents know?
The story is actually – it started in 1988. So, you know, there's an interesting thing, Matthew, that not many people are aware of, but there are sort of two types of quote-unquote spies, right? They're those that are here under diplomatic cover. So they're posing at at an embassy or a consulate, but they're known. And then there's ones like Anna Chapman or the 13 that were named in the recent indictment by Bob Mueller, and those are what are known as NOCs, or non-official cover. They don't have the the protection of diplomatic immunity. The Soviets and the Russians were dealing with my parents and then me were in fact diplomats. So as diplomats, they were constrained by diplomatic rules, one of which is, I believe it's 25 miles that you can travel without prior approval. This is just international law, or international norms rather. You can travel within that country without prior approval of the host nation. So the Russian in New York City actually have a they have a consulate, but they also have a UN mission. So they have a pretty big staff there because they essentially have two offices. And because my parents had a federal contracting firm in New York City, and it was within that 25-mile radius, my sense is that the Russians targeted them just because, as a matter of ease, they were able to travel freely between the consulate and my parents' office, which is on Columbus Circle in Manhattan. So it wasn't just a bookstore, but I think a lot of it had to do with just the ease of access as a starting
point. Okay, so from a very young age, you are kind of a part of this world because the FBI also got involved, right? They started coming in after the Soviet agents would come in and asking questions.
That's right. If I can tell the story very, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the story started actually in 1988. And again, my parents had a small office, not a storefront, but an office in Columbus Circle, for those New York Cityites who know where that is. And one day a man walks into their office, which was odd because they didn't get walk-ins. Walks into the office, you know, wearing a trench coat, and asked to speak to my father, and essentially said, "I want to buy some books," and gave him a list of books. They're books with titles like on nuclear disarmament and you know, weapons proliferation. And he introduced himself as being with the United Nations through the Soviet Union. So my father's thinking, "Oh, this is great. I just got someone. You know, usually I have to hustle to get an account. This is someone who just wants to come from the United Nations to do business here." And so my father was asking him, you know, what kind of books and, you know, how should I ship them? And I said, no, well, I'll pick them up in a couple of weeks. You go order them. And he showed him his business card but didn't give it to him, put it back in his pocket. And probably within 15 minutes, the man had come and gone and just left the list with my dad. So my father got back to work thinking this is great, but kind of put it out of his head until maybe 15, 20 minutes. There was another knock on the door. And this time it was two other men who introduced themselves as FBI special agents. And they said the man showed my father a picture of the man who had just been there, a man named Alex Tomikin, and said, "This man is a Soviet intelligence officer. We'd like to know what he wanted." And my father said, "You just want to buy some books." And so essentially the FBI said, "Well, get him his books. And if he comes back, we will be in touch." Well, that was 1988. My efforts with the FBI ended in 2009. So you can sort of draw the path. How it started in 88, how it started with the Soviets, with the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed. The same people from the United Nations, the Soviet mission to the United Nations, now the Russian mission to the United Nations, came back asking for the same thing. So we had this long history with the Soviets and the Russians and the FBI that spanned several decades. And that's really sort of how it started, this sort of innocuous knock on the door, followed by a Soviet agent and then two FBI agents.
And then in 2001, 9/11 happens.
Yeah. So, you know, as a first generation American, I would often joke that, you know, I learned to fit in. And if there was a group that was determined or whose primary mission in the world was to overthrow Naveed Jamali, I sort of probably could have joined. I just wouldn't have been, I would have been like the treasurer. And I always had this way of sort of getting into groups and sort of fitting in, but I never quite felt like it. And, you know, 9/11 for me was a sort of culminating point. As a young man, as someone, a byproduct of two immigrants, especially in New York, a creation of a, you know, Pakistani man and a French, you know, mother, New York has a strong resonance for me. And the attack sort of redefined what I was doing. I really wanted to join the military. I wanted to join the Navy, become an intelligence officer, found this program. So my sort of foray into this whole adventure really started with that desire. And this long relationship that my parents had with the FBI, after I applied once, did not get in, and was sort of told, "You want to apply for this program? You know, you really want this program? You're going to have to apply again, and you have to work really hard. You just need to show some change." So I approached the FBI in 2005, essentially having been denied the commission the first time and wanting to reapply, with simply asking them, "Hey, if I help you with the Russians, would you write me a letter of recommendation?" So I almost looked at it as an internship. Thinking that the adventure would start if I got into the military, not realizing what I was getting myself into.
And what exactly were you getting yourself into?
As it turns out, from that first meeting with Oleg, who ended up who was the Russian case officer, essentially what the Russians targeted me for was to recruit me to be one of their spies. And 3 years of essentially going through their process, and these are incredibly paranoid people, living undercover on operation where, you know, the FBI was watching me through and watching the Russians through me. And the Russians were essentially looking for any signs of deception, making sure that I was, you know, willing and able. And that's what double agent was. The Russians essentially believed that I was a real spy and welcomed me into their fold of their network of spies. And it was quite an adventure. But I had no idea that that's how it would turn out going into this.
Well, let's back up just a minute. Who was Oleg and how did he approach you? How did he even know to approach you?
So Oleg Kulikov, as I said, my parents started this in 1988. So the Soviets and the Russians would assign what is known as a case officer. So think of an account manager, if you will, in sort of business terms, to oversee various operations and various assets. So over the years, they had a number of case officers that would come and take over my parents' account. And when I returned, when I approached the FBI in 2005, the case officer at the time for the Russians was a man named Oleg Kulikov, who was, a diplomat. He was a captain in the Russian Navy. He was a diplomat, named diplomat, assigned to the United Nations from the Russian Federation. He sat on the military staff committee. He's, you know, again, a legit, appeared to be a legit diplomat, but his side job was really to do what he did with me, which was to target, recruit, and task and communicate with Russia's spies in the United States.
What exactly did that recruitment look like? Did he approach you? Did you approach him knowing that you were going to be working for the FBI? How did that happen?
The Russians by nature are incredibly paranoid. So because the Soviets and the Russians have been doing business with my parents for, you know, for a decade plus at this point, they kept coming to my parents' office. And I started working at the office. My parents were retiring. I was going to take over. And so without, you know, knowing when this would happen, one day Oleg just showed up at my parents' office like they always do. They would randomly come in without announcement to collect their books, their order. They would pay in cash. They would deposit a list of titles for their subsequent order, and that would be it. So one day, out of the blue, I was sitting in the office, and we'd moved the office at this point to Westchester, right outside of New York City, and Oleg Kulikov walked in, and my father introduced me to Oleg and said, essentially, you know, Naveed is going to be taking over. And Oleg looked very, very concerned about me, very, very distrustful, very uneasy, and I tried to sort of break the ice by moving towards comedy and using a joke, which did not go over well. But from that point forward, a curious thing happened, and that was that the Russians, who would come maybe once a quarter, once every 5 months, started coming back. And when I say the Russians, Oleg started coming back several weeks later. So in a much more accelerated version. So they seemed very, very interested in me. And the FBI, with our coaching, we started to kind of meet their demand and try to build a relationship with them.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm wondering, what do you do to make a man like Oleg believe in you? You say that they're very paranoid, so what kind of purity tests, for lack of a better word, do you have to pass to get in good?
Well, the short of it is that they have to believe they're in control, which is very hard when you're trying to shape a conversation. So the trick here, it's psychological warfare of a caliber that is really incredibly intense, because they have to believe they're driving the ship here. But the reality is you're trying to manipulate them, but they have to believe they're in fact manipulating that you. So the first thing is that because the Russians have been coming to my parents' office, there was a level of trust. Even though they were incredibly distrustful, there was still a level of trust that existed there. They believed that my parents' office had not been compromised, that it'd been, it's been around for a while. This was real. So their interests were there. But the second part of this, which you can't force, which is why if you read sort of history of espionage and FBI efforts to counter the Russians, things like walk-ins, things like people volunteering to help the Russians, they're incredibly distrustful of that because they often believe that to be a plan. So in this case, for the Russians to randomly show up, see me there, there's a belief that this probably couldn't have been an FBI operation from the beginning. And so that was their first step, that they were interested in progressing. But essentially, you know, Matthew, for 3 years, the Russians do suitability assessment. They're going to look at you and see the entire time, is there any signs of deception? Is there any signs that this is not real? And the reality is that they don't know. They might know who you are. They might know where you live. They might know what kind of car you drive. They might know where you went to, college and graduate school. But they don't know your personality. So a lot of this is just absolutely required to be face-to-face. It has to be a conversation. These conversations were essentially interrogations where they're trying to suss out, am I telling the same story, the same one that I told 6 months ago? Am I, any sign of deception? If I'm lying about something small, I'm probably lying about something big. And they're just going to drop you. That's it. So a lot of this is just looking for any signs of deception so they can have some confidence in this. The second part, again, it just has to be, can they control you? Are you someone who's reliable? Are you someone who's manipulable but also able to do what you're going to say? And these are all this sort of assessment. And that's why a lot of people that actually get approached by Russia for a number of reasons end up getting dropped because they're viewed as just not being suitable for this kind of assignment. So really, this was this incredible, intense thing where we were trying to manipulate the Russians and making them believe that they were in control when they really weren't. We were laying the breadcrumbs out for them to follow along.
Did you like him?
That's a great question. I didn't like him because I saw him as an adversary. And that was very important to build a wall. In the same way that he built a wall between him and I. I respected him. He was incredibly good. Never underestimate his ability in terms of interrogation, in terms of what they knew, in terms of them following me. Never assume anything. He was damn good. He was really, really good at what he did. But like him, no. I viewed him as a target. I viewed him as an adversary. I was as difficult and obtuse as I could be with him because that's the sort of character that I approached. And I didn't want to have any sort of relationship with him. It was very important to keep that separate. So when he would try to bridge the gap by asking about my wife or asking about my family, I absolutely shut that down because I thought anything that I disclosed on that level, anything personal that they knew about me, they could use against me. So I would say that I respected the hell out of him. I appreciate how good he was. I also viewed him as, a patriot for his country. This is not a terrorist. This is, a man doing his duty. But I very much viewed him as an adversary.
What's the mindset like that you have to get yourself into to do this kind of work and to do something like this for several years? What do you have to tell yourself when you wake up every morning or when you know that you're going to go meet him?
It was really hard. I'm not going to lie. It was hard because to the outside world, none of this was happening. And we would call it the circle of trust. Besides my wife and two FBI agents, no one knew what I was doing. And that has a real heavy weight on a person. It has a heavy weight because there's no sense of satisfaction as to what's happening. Where is this going? Does it matter? There's no sort of conclusion that is, from a day to day that's tangible. In terms of preparing, it was very important to view this as like getting amped up for playing, a football game. Or I would actually watch movies, and I preferred Michael Mann movies like Miami Vice or even James, like the newer James Bond stuff, just to prepare myself to kind of get a little fired up. Like I would actually look at those movies and steal the lines that the characters use and use those with Oleg, because again, it was about being a separate person than you really were. You have to build that defensive wall to protect yourself.
So it was like you created a character and then inhabited that character.
That's exactly right. I and that was very important because for the Russians, they wanted to know what was my motivation for wanting to help them. They had to understand who you were, what you were, in order for them to trust you. If they understand your motivation, they can believe you. And you know, my motivation was really to get the FBI to help me get into the Navy. That was really why I was doing this. That wasn't going to be good enough, so I had to figure out some other way to do this. And I came across, and again, no training, there wasn't any classes or anything like that. The FBI provided no guidance. But I came across, and the readings that I did in terms of studying as much as I could about this, this great acronym called MICE, M-I-C-E, Money, Ideology, Coercion, and Ego. Those are understood to be the sort of four pillars that motivate people to spy. And I looked at that, and I said, okay, well, Oleg knows who I am. He knows my name. He knows all these factual things about me, but he doesn't know what kind of a person I am. So I'm going to build a character based on those four pillars. And what I selected was money and ego. It was just the easiest thing. And it was, you know, so I basically went to Oleg and played the part of a arrogant, money hungry 29 year old who wanted to do business with the Russians because he saw it as a way to make a buck and he was too smart to get caught. And that was exactly the profile that the Russians were looking for. It was exactly what they wanted. And, you know, they took the bait, hook, line, and sinker.
How's the espionage game different today than it was in the Cold War? What's changed? What are the Russians doing differently?
Well, clearly, you know, as we've seen, there's an element of technology. But, Matthew, I go back to – I think that they're not – they're following – first of all, for the Russians, I don't believe the Cold War has ever ended. They're still on a Cold War footing in terms of us being their main adversaries. When their Russian spies come to the United States, they consider themselves being behind enemy territory and they act accordingly. And frankly, they're not wrong to think that. So a lot of the tactics that were used in the height of the Cold War, this is very important for people to understand, are still used today. So the idea of recruiting operational assets, you know, the Russians do not, as much as they want to use, as much as you hear about Twitter and trolls and bots and stealing emails and things like that. The reality is sensitive operations, they do not want to put them across electronic means because they very much fear compromise. So when it comes to gathering intelligence, they continue and will continue to use people like me to gather that intelligence and meet with them in person because they believe that that is more secure to meet an asset in person and exchange information than it is to do something over email, for example. So in a lot of ways, the sources and methods, a lot of the methods that they use are very much the same as in the Cold War.
That seems to be working out for them.
It certainly does. I mean, the idea of recruiting assets and targeting and approaching and dangles and understanding motivation and, you know, we've seen it all. We're seeing it unfold. We're seeing what happened in 26 unfold before our eyes.
It seems to me, at least as an observer, that Russia has gotten better at soft power. Or at least it's playing a different game than everyone else. Do you think that's true?
Yes, that's a great point. When you look at they're clearly the difference between the Cold War and today is that clearly we're not at a wartime military footing in the same way that we were at the height of the 50s or the 60s. That has changed. But look, the Russians were recruiting me to collect military intelligence for them. You know, you only collect military intelligence against someone if you're consider them a military threat. So they still have that desire. But you're right, the soft power is hugely important. And I think that they've really doubled down on their intelligence collection and active measures game because why not? You know, it's a way to destabilize, it's a way to collect intelligence with little to no repercussions. So I do think they've doubled down and they also do things much more aggressively than other countries who are also very active, Iran, North Korea, China, Cuba, you know, these are all countries that do collection in the United States. So, yeah, I think that they put a huge emphasis on this type of operation. It's been hugely effective and it's relatively inexpensive.
What do you think the United States should learn from them? What are we doing or what aren't we doing that maybe they're doing that we should be doing?
I think that we first, as a country, have to take the threat much more seriously. You know, when I was working, when I was operational, everyone was focused on terrorism. Counterterrorism was the flavor of the day, and not that it shouldn't be, but it siphoned resources away from counterintelligence. And counterintelligence had become at this point with the end of the Cold War had become the redheaded stepchild of the intelligence community. There was a point after 9/11 where you know the Department of Homeland Security was going to stand up its own sort of MI5-esque intelligence, domestic intelligence service. And at the time, the FBI director, Robert Mueller, successfully fought it and kept the National Security Division within the FBI. But it's been atrophying. And when I was working with these FBI agents, I would see it just in terms of money. You know, the agents would have the hand-me-down cars. They wouldn't get it was very clear that things like money were going to counterterrorism. And I think that that's a mistake. I'm not saying that we should abandon counterterrorism, but it seems to me like counterintelligence simply did not get the priority that it deserves, that is equal to the threat and the risk to the United States.
Do you think that that's why the 2016 election meddling stuff has gone down the way it's had, just because the resources weren't pointed in that direction?
I think it's part of it. I don't want to say that it's all of it. You know, as you saw from the Mueller indictment, and this is an unclassified indictment, you know, the stuff that they released, it's pretty impressive when you think about it. When you think about what the intelligence community was able to collect and surveil against the Russians. I mean, they really had this stuff being viewed. So I do think there is part of that. I think that part of it is political. A large part of this is political rather than it is just resource wise. I mean, the acceptance of Russia and frankly, other, you know, again, China, North Korea, Cuba, Iran, the acceptance that intelligence operations against the United States are going to become a thing as countries decide not to use hard power against us. No one wants to go to war. This is a convenient, easy, low risk way to impact your adversary. So I do think part of it leading up to 2016 was not just some atrophying of the counterintelligence community, but rather politically a failure to respect the threat that Russia poses in the intelligence realm.
Why do you think there's been that failure? I mean, I feel it, you know, as somebody that's been covering conflict in Russia for a while now, I feel that. I feel like people didn't take it seriously until, you know, this.
Because we won the Cold War, man. No one wants to admit that we may have won the Cold War in a sort of military sense. You know, they call it war termination. We declared victory. The Russians also declared victory. Or they didn't declare the war over. We declared victory and the war is over. The Russians remained on the intelligence side as the U.S. and NATO and democracy as their main enemy. So everything that they do is aligned, and that's their national interest. Everything they do is aligned to that. I think that we've put ourselves in a position that, you know, capitalism prevailed against communism, the free world prevailed, and that's why the Cold War ended. And the reality is that there's truth to that, but there's a much more real politique way of looking at this, which a realistic way of looking at this, which is Russia still exists. It might be smaller, but it's still aligned very much in sort of the Soviet approach to the United States. They're not looking at us as you know, as a friend. They're looking at us as their main adversary.
Did you happen to watch – we're recording this, by the way, on March 1st. And I guess what would have been last night, kind of in the middle of the night here in the U.S., Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the legislators and gave a two-hour-long speech.
Right.
Did you happen to see that?
I've seen clips of it, and I think that it's the tone of it is exactly what I'm saying. There, mm-hmm. the bluster of, you know, threatening weapons. You know, I think Americans don't understand how much NATO, for example, is something the Russians and democracy, for another, the Russians fear. They see these former Soviet states either becoming part of NATO or becoming democracies. And they see, and Putin himself sees that as a threat. I mean, he sees NATO in this Cold War picture at his doorstep. We don't, because we have the benefit of two oceans. He doesn't have that same vantage point. This isn't Sarah Palin. I can see Russia from my house. This is Vladimir Putin. I can see NATO at our borders, and that really worries them. They believe that NATO is still determined to finish off Russia. Again, the Cold War has never ended. So it just tells you their tone, their intent. And we have been ignoring that intent. We've been ignoring the threat. We've been deprioritizing that Russia has said over and over again, they view United States, they view a nuclear armed NATO alliance, they view democracy as a threat. It's as simple as that. And they're going to act accordingly.
I want to ask you something I ask everybody that comes on here when we talk about Russia, that's a Russian expert. What does Vladimir Putin want? And what does Russia want? And are those the same thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Vladimir Putin would say that what he wants is what Russia wants. I'm sure of that. But I don't think that's the case. I think that Vladimir Putin is very, very worried about Vladimir Putin staying in power. You know, look, Vladimir Putin is essentially a Slavic Saddam Hussein. You know, despots don't fade away to Boca or retire to Boca to live out their days. So there is a legitimate concern with Vladimir Putin that if he's deposed or he leaves office, that it's not just that his power wanes. You know, I think there's a legitimate concern. I don't see that he's ever going to leave power totally willingly. So there's part of it is self-preservation. That's Vladimir Putin. And that's clearly not what Russia wants. I mean, you know, it's sort of like China. The Russians control state media. They control the internet. They control news in a total way that we are not used to. We've seen disinformation here in the 2016 with the Russians, you know, pushing certain news stories. But that's not what Russia is. It really is a controlled vacuum of information. I think that Russian people, you know, they just like Americans, they want to live their lives, be prosperous, you know, and safe and raise their children. That being said, I think that they are being sort of fed this propaganda. There's no doubt about that internally. And so in a lot of ways, you know, Putin has an incredibly high rating by the Russian people. But I'm sure if there were free and open elections, I really wonder if he would continue to win. I would say that the fact that they're, you know, that it's, you know, these aren't true democratic or free and open elections by any stretch of the imagination.
Naveed Jamali, thank you so much for coming on War College and sharing your story. The book is How to Catch a Russian Spy, and it is out in paperback.
Thanks for listening to this week's show. You know, we've got an entire archive online at acast.com/warcollege. That's more than 2.5 years of episodes. So check them out. And we love reading your reviews, especially ones like this from Chucklehead666. Super cogent, nonpartisan insider info about the real global story. If you feel anything like that, please leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere else you get the show. It helps other people find us. War College is me, Jason Fields, and Matthew Gault. We'll be back next week.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.